Wall Street Journal, September 29th, 2019, be included in the record.
Without objection.
I have a unanimous consent request that an article entitled Whistleblower Reaches Agreement to Testify will appear very soon, Representative Adam Schiff says, USA Today, September 29th, 2019.
Without objection.
I have a unanimous consent request, article entitled Schiff Confirms Tentative Agreement for Whistleblower to Testify Before House Intelligence Committee, CNN, September 29th, 2019.
Without objection.
I have a unanimous consent request. Intelligence panel has deal to hear whistleblower's testimony, says Schiff, Washington Post, September 29th, 2019.
Without objection.
I have a unanimous consent request. An article entitled Whistleblower Reportedly Agrees to Testify Before House Intelligence Committee, reported by Schiff, Huffington Post, September 29th, 2019.
Without objection.
I have a unanimous consent request. An article titled Schiff, Panel Will Hear from Whistleblower, Arkansas Democrat Gazette, September 29th, 2019.
Without objection, the time of the gentleman has expired. I now recognize Ms. Sewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, in your prior testimony, you spoke so movingly about your family background. You stated that your parents fled communist and Nazi regimes and that they valued freedom and democracy offered in America, having experienced totalitarian regimes. Did that have any effect on your desire to enter into the United States Foreign Service?
Yes, it did.
Did you always know that you wanted to be in the Foreign Service? I look at your background, and it is perfectly suited for what you're doing. I note that you studied at the Pushchinsky State Russian Language Institute in Russia to learn Russian.
Yeah.
That you have do you also have an MS from the National Defense University National War College?
Yes.
I even noticed that you earned your undergraduate degree in history and Russian studies in college, and coincidentally that was also my college, but I wanted, and you definitely are doing Princeton and the nation service by what you do every day, but I really want to know how it felt to have your reputation sullied, not for state and nation, but for personal gain. You spoke about how your service is not just your own personal service, it affects your family. And today we've seen you as this former ambassador, this 33-year veteran of the Foreign Service, but I want to know about you personally and how this has affected you personally and your family.
Yeah, it's been a difficult time. I mean, I'm a private person. I don't want to put all that out there, but it's been a very, very difficult time because the president does have the right to have his own or her own ambassador in every country in the world.
But does the president have the right to actually malign people's character? I mean, it may not be against any law, but I would think that it would be against decorum and decency.
I mean, there's a question as to why the kind of campaign to get me out of Ukraine happened, because all the president has to do is say he wants a different ambassador. And in my line of work, perhaps in your line of work as well, all we have is our reputation. And so this has been a very painful period.
How has it affected your family?
I really don't want to get into that, but thank you for asking.
Because I do care. I also want to know how you think it affected your fellow colleagues in the Foreign Service. My Republican colleagues have said that since you received such adulation from and embracing from your own fellow colleagues, that what occurred, the incident that occurred with the president and his cronies, you know, maligning your reputation, how has that had a chilling effect on the ability and the morale within the Foreign Service? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that it has had exactly that, a chilling effect, not only in Embassy Kyiv, but throughout the State Department, because people don't know kind of whether their efforts to pursue our stated policy are going to be supported. And that is a dangerous place to be.
Now, for the record, my Republican colleagues will probably try to paint you as a never-Trumper. Are you a never-Trumper?
No.
As a Foreign Service officer, you took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States without regard for who's in office. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
Have you also served in your 33 years for not just Democratic presidents, but also Republican presidents?
Four Republican presidents.
Four Republican presidents. In fact, you joined the Foreign Service under Reagan. Is that not right?
Yes, that's true.
Now, why do you think it's really important that Foreign Service officers are nonpartisan? Can you talk to us about why it's important for you to do your job and your fellow Foreign Service officers to do your job that you're nonpartisan?
Yeah, because our work is essentially nonpartisan. And, you know, Senator Vandenberg, a Republican senator who actually partnered with President Truman, coined a phrase that politics should stop at the water's edge. And I think that's exactly right, because while obviously the competition of ideas in a democracy with different parties, different individuals, is hugely important, but at the end of the day, when we are dealing with other countries, it needs to be about what is right for the United States. Those are our national security interests. And whether an individual works for the CIA or the military or the State Department, we've got to be nonpartisan and thinking about what is right for the United States.
Well, on behalf of a grateful nation, I want to say thank you for your service, and I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Mr. Turner.
Ambassador, I want to say I have a great deal of respect for what you do. I serve on the Armed Services Committee, the Intelligence Committee. I've worked with the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, including being its president, and I know the complexity of what you do. I know you have little access directly to decision makers, little resources, but you have still a great deal of responsibility. It's a complex task, and I want to take us from just the concept of one-dimensional Ukraine being corrupt to the other issues that you had to deal with as the Ukraine ambassador. You had to deal with more than just our bilateral relationship with Ukraine, for example. And I'd like confirmation that, I mean, obviously I know you know these, but these were on your portfolio. You had to deal with the issue of the OSCE Budapest Agreement and the denuclearization of Ukraine and the issues of its territorial integrity of the signatories, correct?
Could you run that by me again?
The OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation for Europe, mm-hmm. and the Budapest Agreement, under which Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons and believed they had its territorial integrity guaranteed by the United States and Russia. Mm-hmm. You would have had that in your portfolio.
Well, that
was an issue you would have to deal with the Ukrainians on.
Yeah, when the Ukrainians would ask about our policy and whether it was in keeping with the Budapest Agreement.
Excellent. NATO. Ukraine is an aspiring NATO country. And, of course, you have the Bucharest summit where the U.S. and the NATO allies made a statement that they would get membership. That would have been on your portfolio. They would have been discussing with you.
Yes, certainly aspirations to NATO membership would
right.
be.
And it's also consistent with U.S. policy that the U.S. supports Ukraine joining the EU, and they have a great deal of interest and desire for joining the EU, correct?
Yes.
And they just had a summit in Ukraine in July where they talked about the associated agreement on economic integration between the Ukrainians and the EU. And they also had a discussion about the illegal annexation of Crimea and the blocking by Russia of the Ukrainian sailors that came out of the Azov Sea and that were captured. Those would have all been issues that would have been in your portfolio and that were consistent with what the EU's issues are, correct?
Yes. We work closely with our EU partners.
In addition to Ukraine, you'd have to work with France and UK and Germany, all of which you have different ideas of those. The ambassadors to the Ukraine of France, Germany, and correct?
Yeah. Did you say they all have different ideas about these issues?
Some of them, yes.
But mostly there's a consensus.
You'd have to work with NGOs, non-governmental organizations, on issues that we heard about, legal aid, human trafficking, building democratic institutions, and even HIV/AIDS, right?
Yes.
And you've spoken at several NGOs while you were the ambassador to Ukraine.
Yes.
Now, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, they would have under their portfolio aspiring nations to the EU, would they not?
Yeah.
Okay, so EU Ambassador Sondland then would have had Ukraine in his portfolio because they're an aspiring nation and he's our U.S. ambassador to the EU, correct?
I think he testified that one of his first...
But you agree that it's within his portfolio, correct?
He's answering the question.
You would agree that it's in his portfolio, would you not? Yes.
I would agree.
Yes,
that
thank you. Now, I want to go to the next
question. I'm sorry. Can you finish your answer, please?
Richard Holbrooke is a person who I have a great deal of reverence for.
Ms. Yovanovitch should not finish her answer. You may finish your answer, Ambassador.
Not out of my time. You're done.
Nope.
Right?
Ambassador? The ambassador will be recognized.
I would say that all EU ambassadors deal with other countries, including aspiring countries, but it is unusual to name the U.S. ambassador to the EU to be responsible for all aspects of Ukraine.
I'll take your additional answer. It's still in his portfolio, which was my question. You knew Ambassador Holbrooke, probably. I did. He's a man of great integrity, one of our most successful ambassadors. You know him probably by his reputation. You would agree that he was a man of great reputation, right?
Yes.
Yes. Madam Ambassador, would it surprise you if in 2004 John Kerry had a member of his campaign who was a foreign policy advisor who traveled to the Ukraine in July and met with Ukrainian officials and the U.S. ambassador? Would that surprise you? A member of John Kerry's campaign team for President of the United States in 2004 traveled to Ukraine, met with the U.S. ambassador in July.
Not necessarily. What
would you have taken that meeting if a member of John Kerry's campaign traveled to the Ukraine? Would you have taken that meeting?
I guess it would depend on what the purpose of the meeting was.
Well, that meeting actually occurred, and it was with John Holbrooke. John Holbrooke was a private citizen, traveled to Ukraine, met with U.S. ambassadors, met with Ukrainian officials. He was also there on about HIV/AIDS, which was, in addition, something that the Clinton Foundation was working on. So we have a official of the John Kerry campaign in 2004 as a private citizen meeting with our ambassador in Ukraine.
Time of the gentleman has expired.
Unusual.
We meet with private individuals all the time.
It probably wasn't unusual for Giuliani.
Gentlemen's time has expired. Mr. Carson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Madam Ambassador. Madam Ambassador, returning to the topic of corruption, we heard evidence that you were successful at promoting efforts to address corruption. On Wednesday, in testifying about your very sterling career as a champion of anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine, Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent said, quote, "You can't promote principled anti-corruption action without pissing off corrupt people," end quote. It seems that your efforts as ambassador to essentially reform the powerful prosecutor general's office in Ukraine did exactly that. Madam Ambassador, what concerned you about the prosecutor general's office when you were the ambassador in Ukraine?
What concerned us was that there didn't seem to be any progress in the three overall objectives that Mr. Lutsenko had laid out, most importantly for the Ukrainian people, but also the international community. So the first thing was reforming the Prosecutor General's office. It's a tremendously powerful office where they had authority not only to conduct investigations, so an FBI-like function, but also to do the actual prosecution. So very, very wide powers, which is part of that Soviet legacy. And there just wasn't a lot of progress in that. There wasn't a lot of progress in handling personnel issues and how the structure should be organized and who should have the important jobs, because some of the people in those jobs were known to were considered to be corrupt themselves. Secondly, the issue that was tremendously important to the Ukrainian people of bringing justice to the over 100 people who died on the Maidan during the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. Nobody has been held accountable for that. And that is, you know, kind of an open wound for the Ukrainian people. And thirdly, Ukraine needs all the money that it has. And there is a strong belief that former President Yanukovych and those around him made off with over $40 billion. $40 billion, that's a lot in the U.S. It's a huge amount of money in Ukraine. And so, again, nobody has, none of that money has really been, I think maybe $1 billion was repatriated, but the rest of it is still missing.
Madam Ambassador, was the head of that office corrupt?
We believe so.
And you got the sense, did you not, that he was a driving force behind some of the attacks against you?
I did.
which ultimately led to your removal, correct?
Yes.
But it wasn't just him. His allegations were picked up and spread by Mr. Giuliani and Donald Trump Jr., were they not?
Yes.
So let me get this straight. You are effective at fighting corruption in the Ukraine. Fighting that corruption was important to the national security of the United States, and you were punished for that, ultimately being removed from your post by the President of the United States. So in your opinion, Madam Ambassador, why is it important to have a nonpartisan career in the Foreign Services?
I think it's important to have a nonpartisan career Foreign Service office, or service, I should say.
Sure.
Because what we do is inherently nonpartisan. It is about our national security interests. It's not about what is good for a particular party at a particular time. It has to be about the greater interests of our security in, frankly, what is an increasingly dangerous world.
And could you briefly describe for us what broad U.S. policies you have sought to advance in your 33 years of service, and specifically in post-Soviet states like Ukraine?
Well, that's a broad question. But I think that certainly in my time in Russia, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, all of these countries are very different, as is Ukraine. I think that establishing positive, constructive relations to the extent that we can with those countries is really important. There are three basic areas. One is security, the second is economic, and the third is political. And so working all the sub-issues, your colleague mentioned many of them, we certainly did that in Ukraine as well.
Thank you for your service. I yield to the chairman.
Thanks.
Dr. Winstrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Madam Ambassador, thank you very much for being here. And I just want to start by saying I appreciate your years of service and enduring years of moving around the world to dangerous places. And hearing from you today, I realize that we share some of the same feelings and experiences. As an Army Reserve surgeon, I received a call on a Monday afternoon in March of 2005 that told me I was being deployed to Iraq and I had to be out the door in the next 2 to 3 days. I had patients scheduled for months. I had surgeries scheduled and had to go. So I understand that shocking feeling that can come with some abrupt change like that. And I was in processing a few days later, and I was told my orders would say you're going for 18 months, but it may be a little shorter than that. But I served a year in Iraq, 2005-2006, one of the bloodiest times of the war. And this is where I have another personal relationship with what you were talking about. I saw a nation in Iraq of people that craved a non-corrupt government. And sadly today, even though it helped to remove Saddam Hussein, they still have corruption concerns in Iraq. And I can relate to what you said just a few moments ago, that it feels like an open wound when it hasn't been resolved. But you might imagine, with that military experience and background, I take an interest in military strategy and capabilities and the thoughts of those with boots on the ground, like you and Mr. Volker and Mr. Taylor. In your deposition on page 144, your quote is saying, in terms of lethal assistance, we all felt it was very significant that this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. Just real quick, who in general makes up we all? Would that be the team I mentioned?
Can I just one second. What line is that?
Well, I have to move on. You said we all felt it was very significant that this administration made the decision to provide lethal weapons to Ukraine. I assume that is those that have boots on the ground. And then this administration, I assume you meant the Trump administration.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. In your deposition, also on page 144, you spoke about the generosity of Congress. You mentioned it today, increasing aid to Ukraine. And part of your deposition, after that statement that I quoted before, you were asked, did you advocate for that? You responded, yes. Then you were asked, did you advocate for that prior to the new administration in 2016? And you responded, well, yeah. On page 148, the question was, were you satisfied that the administration was doing what was necessary to support Ukraine? You said, in what respect? And they said, in, you know, helping them deter Russian aggression, helping them with foreign aid and foreign assistance. And you said, yeah. And I agree that that lethal assistance was very significant, as you said. And I thank you for that. And I thank Mr. Volker, and I thank Mr. Taylor. You know, Acting Ambassador Taylor was here Wednesday. He testified about the president's decision to withhold lethal aid, and he said the president felt it might provoke Russia. And Mr. Taylor contested then that Russia has already been provoked and they have invaded the Ukraine. You know, President Obama had the right to make his own foreign policy and make his own decisions as president of the United States, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's an interagency process, and obviously Congress
has
a role as well.
He has the right as president. I respect the interagency process. I'm getting to that, actually. But he has the right to make his own foreign policy and make his own decisions as president of the United States, as do all presidents, correct?
Yes.
So we have one president, Obama, who denied lethal aid altogether, in spite of ambassadors and other boots on the ground recommending, making that recommendation, such as you did. We have another president, Trump, who vetted those that were going to receive the aid and provided it consistent with your intra-agency recommendations and that of your colleagues. Let me just ask you from a military standpoint, without javelins, would you agree the Russians had much greater military offensive options and flexibility in their effort to attack the Ukraine without the Ukraine having javelins?
Yeah, I mean, they had another option, although the tank war is no longer the war that is being fought in Ukraine.
But I'm just saying, with the javelin.
Yeah, it's another option.
And there's a reason for that, because the javelins are there. And so I think that changes the scenario. But I just wanted to make that point, that the president has a right to have their own foreign policy and to make their own decisions. And with that, I yield back.
Yeah. If I could just supplement one of my answers.
Of course.
So I want to thank you for your service as well. But what I'd like to say is, while I obviously don't dispute that the president has the right to withdraw an ambassador at any time for any reason. But what I do wonder is why it was necessary to smear my reputation.
Also. Well, I wasn't asking about that, but thank you very much, ma'am.
Representative Speer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ambassador, so very much. You were confirmed by the Senate on a voice vote, weren't you?
Yes.
So unanimous, Republicans and Democrats, correct?
Yes.
No dispute. You said that in summer of 2018, the smear campaign began in your testimony earlier today. Did Secretary Pompeo at any time come to your aid?
Well, my understanding from Assistant Secretary Phil Rieker and Deputy Secretary Sullivan is that, this sort of the rumors about me, for lack of a better word, the smear campaign, which was behind closed doors at that point, there were a number of discussions between the president and Secretary Pompeo, and that he actually did keep me in place for as long as he could. That's what I was told.
So it appears that back in 2018, the president was already making noises that he wanted you out of there. It appears that as early as April of 2018, Mr. Parnas was at a fundraiser for the president and recommended that you be removed. And then subsequently, in May of 2018, was pictured at a White House dinner with the president. And then later in May, made a contribution of over $325,000 illegally to the president's reelection campaign. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware of the press about those things.
Does that help you understand a little bit more why this smear campaign was underway?
Yes, I mean.
All right, you made some very riveting comments in your statement this morning that I just want to repeat because I think we should have you expand on it. You said, I've always understood that I served at the pleasure of the president. I still find it difficult to comprehend that foreign and private interests were able to undermine U.S. interests in this way. Individuals who apparently felt stymied by our efforts to promote stated U.S. policy against corruption, that is, to do our mission, were able to successfully conduct a campaign of disinformation against a sitting ambassador using unofficial back channels. Now, as I listened to you make that statement, I was thinking of all the other persons in the Foreign Service who now have to be concerned that it's not good enough to follow the stated U.S. foreign policy, but also to be aware that maybe the president has a back channel of interests that he is promoting that is diametrically opposed to our stated foreign policy. Can you expand on that, please?
Well, I think that it's important that whoever is representing the president, an ambassador, speaks with the full authority of the president and our foreign policy establishment. And if there are others who are also helping with the responsibilities in that country, for example, Ambassador Kurt Volker with his important mission to bring peace to the Donbass, that we all speak with one voice, that it's all about our common security interests, and that it's not about, personal gain or commercial gain or anything else, that it's about our national security.
But in this case, the Tres Amigos appeared to be more interested in getting an investigation than into promoting an anti-corruption effort in Ukraine. Is that correct?
That appears to be the case.
You were told at one point in 2019, in February of earlier this year, you spoke to a minister in Ukraine who warned that when it came to Rudy Giuliani, you needed to, quote, watch your back. What did you understand him to mean?
I didn't exactly know, the rumor was out there at that time, and in fact, I think this minister also shared that information with me that the mayor was working to have me removed.
Let me just say, to conclude, that you have endured an orchestrated character assassination, that it was hatched over a year and a half ago, and that it's laced with enormous campaign contributions to the president's reelection campaign. And you deserve more from the American people, and you deserve more from Congress in supporting you. I yield back.
I have unanimous consent.
Mr. Stewart, you're recognized.
I have unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman.
We can take that up later, Mr. Stewart. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and others. And Ambassador, thank you for being with us here today. Welcome, as I said last a couple days ago to the witnesses. Welcome to year four of the impeachment proceedings. I'm sorry that you've gotten drugged into this. For 3 years, we've heard these outrageous and frankly unbelievable accusations regarding Russian collusion, accusations that we now know are absolute nonsense, that there was no basis at all, despite promises from some members of this committee that they had secret proof that would prove this collusion. And again, we know that it was nonsense. But now in year four, we apparently move on to Ukraine and quid pro quo, culminating yesterday when the speaker announced that the president would indeed be impeached and removed for office for bribery. And with that statement, I would now feel compelled to ask you, Madam Ambassador, as you sit here before us, very simply and directly, do you have any information regarding the President of the United States accepting any bribes?
No.
Do you have any information regarding any criminal activity that the President of the United States has been involved with at all?
No.
Thank you. Thank you for answering that directly. The American people know this is nonsense. The American people know this is unfair. And I have a prediction regarding this. I think that public support for impeachment is actually going to be less when these hearings are over than it is when the hearings began. Because finally, the American people are going to be able to see the evidence. And they're going to be able to make their own determination regarding that. Now, I want to ask you one thing very quickly, and you've been asked this again and again, but my question is slightly different. You've been asked, as you recognize, that the president, any president, has the ability to ask his ambassadors to serve at will. I'm curious, do you think that's the right policy?
Yeah, I probably think it is.
I do as well. It may be imperfect. There may be times when it's not used perfectly, but I agree with you. It is the right policy. I don't think that we should change that. Now, I'd like to read from some previous statements, including one of your own, as well as others, regarding the appropriateness of investigating corruption in the UK. From Ms. Fiona Hill. So again, the fact that there are investigations into corruption in the energy sector in Ukraine, as well as Russia and many other countries, is not a surprise. From yourself, your previous testimony. Question. Was it the general understanding that Burisma was a company that suffered from allegations of corruption? Your answer was yes. From Ambassador Sondland, I just am generally aware that Burisma is considered a potentially corrupt company. Would you agree then that it's appropriate to investigate corruption?
I think it's appropriate if it's part of our national strategy. What I would say is that we have a process for doing that. It's called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. We have one with Ukraine, and generally it goes from our Department of Justice to the Ministry of Justice in the country of interest.
Okay,
and that's the usual path.
And I appreciate that. Regardless of the process, though, it's appropriate for us to investigate in potential corruption. And especially, look, we're about to give some of these countries hundreds of millions of dollars. That the U.S. taxpayer said, here's a dollar of mine, go ahead and give it to this other country. But please only do it if you know it's not going to be used for corrupt purposes or against our national interest. And I'll conclude with this, because I promised my friend, Mr. Jordan, I would save him a little bit of time. We mentioned earlier that the Vice President, when he went to the Ukraine and called for the specific firing of a specific prosecutor, that he was, as they say, completing official U.S. policy. But the interesting thing is this. The Vice President had exactly two countries that were his responsibility at that time, China and the Ukraine. And he has bragged and been very proud of his influence in the previous administration. He says again and again that the Obama administration listened to him, so it doesn't surprise me that they would be fulfilling a policy that this Vice President certainly helped to formulate. Mr. Jordan, I leave you.
Sir, if you just want to clarify, it was Cyprus and Ukraine and China.
In Cyprus, I'm sorry. thank you. Clarification. And I will yield for unanimous consent.
I have unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman, that doesn't involve you this time. It's three articles, a New York Times article, 2004 campaign, the advisors, Kerry foreign policy crew, has a Clintonian.
Time of the gentleman has expired.
Kiev Post, Holbrooke to visit Kiev, July 2004.
And the Brahma
News,
recognize you later.
Holbrooke meets with one Ukrainian American.
Gentlemen, time has expired.
Organization. I'd like to have that
Mr.
unanimous consent.
Mr. Quigley, you're recognized. Mr. Quigley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. It's like a Hallmark movie. You ended up at Georgetown. This is all okay. But it wasn't your preference 7-8 months ago, correct?
No, it was not.
Wasn't your preference to be the victim of a smear campaign, was it?
No.
Wasn't your preference to be defamed by the President of the United States, including today, was it?
No.
Wasn't your preference to be ousted at seemingly the pinnacle of your career, was it?
No.
You wanted to finish your extended tour, correct?
I did.
What did you want to do after that? Did you know?
I wasn't sure.
There's nothing wrong with Georgetown. It's a fine place, right?
It's a wonderful place.
But it's your only choice at the end of a distinguished career after all that. It's not the end of a Hallmark movie. It's the end of a really bad reality TV show brought to you by someone who knows a lot about that. Why did you... You previously testified that you sought advice from Ambassador Sondland at this time about what to do. Is that correct?
I did.
And why did you reach out to the ambassador?
Because this was clearly so political and was not going to be, you know, the State Department was not in a position, shall we say, to manage the issue. It didn't appear to me. And so I asked Ambassador Sondland, who said that he, you know, he was a political appointee. He said he was close to the president. And so he had just been in Ukraine for a ship visit with some of his EU colleagues from Brussels. And so I reached out to him for advice. When this was no longer a Ukraine kind of an interview with Mr. Lutsenko, kind of a Ukrainian, but it became sort of the American American politicians and pundits, et cetera, were repeating those allegations, I asked him for advice.
And it meant a lot to you. This was an extraordinary time. It meant, and the advice meant a lot. And what was his advice?
Well, he suggested that I needed to go big or go home, and he said that the best thing to do would be to, you know, send out a tweet, praise the president, that sort of thing.
And what was your reaction to that advice?
Well, my reaction was that I'm sure he meant well, but it was not advice that I could really follow. It felt it felt partisan. It felt political. And I just, that was not something that I thought was in keeping with my role as ambassador and a foreign service officer.
Did he give you any specific suggestions on what to say about the President of the United States, or just say something nice about him?
Yeah, just to praise him.
Thank you. I yield the balance to the chairman.
I want to follow up on Ms. Quigley's line of question and also harken back to something you were asked by minority counsel earlier. You were asked a couple of questions. Do you think you could have done more to push back against the smear campaign? I'm not suggesting this is what the counsel was getting at, but sometimes victims are asked, aren't you responsible for your own victimization? What would you say to people who say, isn't it kind of your fault, Ambassador, that you didn't fight your own smear harder?
Well, I think that, you know, I've been a Foreign Service officer for a long time. And just like the military, we have our own culture, we have our own kind of chain of command, so to speak. And I did everything that I could to address these issues and ask the State Department to do what I felt was the right thing, which was support me when it was important to do so, because it was also about supporting the policy. I think it was for others to stand up for me.
I quite agree. Representative Stefanik.
Thank you. Since the chairman has gaveled out all of my colleagues with their unanimous consent, I am going to read for the record many of the chairman's comments in September of the importance of hearing from the whistleblower. Again, Ambassador, thank you for your patience. Thank you for your service. But since we haven't been able to conduct ourselves in normal procedures, I'm just going to use the 5 minutes for this. September 29th in the Wall Street Journal, quote, the whistleblower at the center of the impeachment investigation of President Trump will testify in the House very soon. This is a quote by the chairman. USA Today, September 29th. Talking with ABC News this week, Schiff, the Democrat who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, said the whistleblower would testify very soon, and the only thing standing in the way was getting security clearances for the attorneys representing the whistleblower so they could attend the testimony. From Vox, September 29th, Rep. Adam Schiff said Sunday the whistleblower at the center of a growing scandal surrounding President Donald Trump will testify before the House Intelligence Committee very soon. On CNN, September 29th, Schiff said Sunday on ABC as well as NBC's Meet the Press that he expects the whistleblower to testify very soon. The Washington Post, September 29th. In an appearance on ABC News this week, Schiff echoed Pelosi's message. He also said he expected the Intelligence Committee to hear from the whistleblower very soon, pending a security clearance from Acting Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire. In the Huffington Post, Schiff told ABC's this week that he expects the whistleblower to appear before this committee very soon. In the New York Post, quote, we'll get the unfiltered testimony of that whistleblower. In the Washington Times, quote, that whistleblower will be allowed to come in. These are all quotes from Chairman Adam Schiff. In Talking Points memo, the question was posed, actually this was by George Stephanopoulos, have you reached an agreement yet with the whistleblower and his or her attorneys about coming before the committee and providing the information firsthand? Quote, yes we have, Schiff responded, and as DNI McGuire promised during the hearing, that whistleblower will be allowed to come in and come in without a minder from the Justice Department or from the White House to tell the whistleblower what they can and cannot say. We'll get the unfiltered testimony of that whistleblower. In Daily Kos, we're ready to hear from the whistleblower as soon as that is done, and we'll keep obviously riding shotgun to make sure that the acting director doesn't delay in that clearance process. In CNBC, we'll get the unfiltered testimony of that whistleblower. In Market Watch, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said Sunday that an agreement has been reached under which the whistleblower will testify before the committee very soon. I can keep going, but again, the chairman refused to allow us to put these into the record with unanimous consent. So I've read those out, and as we know, it is important to protect whistleblowers from retaliation and from firing, and we want to make sure whistleblowers are able to come forward. But in this case, the fact that we are getting criticized by Chairman Adam Schiff for statements that he himself made early on in this process shows the duplicity and just the abuse of power that we are continuing to see. With a minute 54 seconds left, I'll yield to my colleague, Mr. Jordan.
I thank the gentlelady for yielding. I would also add that the chairman has promised we'll get to see the transcripts. But there's still four people we've deposed that we have not been able to use the see their transcripts, have their transcripts released, and therefore the testimony they provided we're not able to use in these open hearings. If it's an open hearing, all the available testimony from depositions that has been taken by the committee should be available to be discussed for the American people to see. But no, no, no. Mr. Morris and Mr. Hale and two others have not yet been released. So I hope the chairman releases that. One other point I would make in the last minute of Ms. Stefanik's time. The Democrats have asserted that this whole thing with Ambassador Yovanovitch was part of some sinister scheme by the White House to get President Zelensky to do an investigation. If recalling Ambassador Yovanovitch was part of some scheme by Trump and Pompeo and Giuliani to get President Zelensky to do an investigation, why would they replace her with the Democrats' first witness, their star witness, Bill Taylor? I mean, that if that's the plan, not the best plan I've ever seen put together. Their star witness, their first witness, Mr. Taylor, was here Wednesday. That's what they were up to? I think it just demonstrates that is not what went on here. Mr. Zelensky never undertook any investigations, and the reason the aid was released, as we discussed on Wednesday, was because Vice President Pence, Ambassador Bolton, and U.S. senators all talked with President Zelensky, and they were convinced he was the real deal, as the ambassador has alluded to in her testimony. That's why the money was released. That I yield back.
Mr. Swalwell.
Mr. Chairman, a lot has changed since the whistleblower came forward. Two things in particular. First, most of what the whistleblower has alleged has been corroborated by the witnesses that we have heard from. Second, the president, who my colleagues so shamelessly continue to defend, continue to pressure, threaten, and intimidate the whistleblower. So I'd like unanimous consent to put into the record a September 26, 2019 article from Business Insider. Trump suggested the whistleblower who filed a complaint against him is guilty of treason, which is punishable by death.
Without objection.
How about September 26, 2019, Vanity Fair? Trump suggests executing the whistleblower's sources, like, quote, in the good old days. Third?
Without objection.
September 29th, whistleblower's lawyer raises fear for client safety.
Without
objection. From Axios. Mr. Chairman, the whistleblower has an absolute right to anonymity. The whistleblower's lawyer has said that he fears for his personal safety and will only answer questions now in writing. I wish my colleagues would join me in protecting the whistleblower's right to anonymity. But here, Ms. Ivanovich, we are here to talk about you and what you witnessed. And you saw a lot as it related to Mr. Giuliani. And I want to read a quote to you from Mr. Giuliani, but first ask you, when you were in Ukraine, you understood that Rudy Giuliani was Donald Trump's personal lawyer. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Are you familiar with Rudy Giuliani's quote in the New York Times describing himself as the lawyer saying, quote, he basically knows what I'm doing, comma, sure, as his lawyer? Were you familiar with that quote?
It sounds familiar.
And you have a lawyer with you today, Ms. Ivanovich.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand that lawyers act on their client's behalf. Is that right?
Yes.
That it would be improper for a lawyer to go outside any directive that a client gives. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
Are you familiar with a New York Times story on May 9, 2019, where Rudy Giuliani says that he intends to visit Ukraine and says, we're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation. Are you familiar with that quote?
Yes.
That's 11 days before you were removed as ambassador. Is that right?
Yes.
He is talking publicly about designs on coming to Ukraine. But what I think is interesting is that Mr. Giuliani says, we're, as in we are. He doesn't say I am not meddling in an election. He doesn't say I'm not meddling in an investigation. He says we. He's speaking for himself and his client. And I want to talk about that quote, we're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation. Is it proper for you or anyone who acts on behalf of the United States government to meddle in an investigation?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not?
Well, there are law enforcement channels, and things need to be handled properly and without any kind of political bias.
Now, this anti-corruption crusader, President Trump, who my colleagues have touted out as having such a great interest in anti-corruption, in both the calls that have been referenced today, the August 21 call and the July 25 call, isn't it true that President Trump never mentions the word corruption?
Yes, that's true.
And as far as the foreign aid that my colleagues keep saying, well, he can't be guilty. He didn't complete the cheat. The aid went to the Ukrainians. Isn't it true that the only reason the aid, or the only time the aid went to the Ukrainians, was after the whistleblower complaint became public?
Yes, it was after the whistleblower complaint became public.
So you don't really get points when you get your hand caught in the cookie jar and someone says, hey, he's got his hand in the cookie jar, and then you take your hand out, which is essentially what my Republican colleagues and the president are trying to take credit for. Finally, I want to put up the disgusting tweet from the president today, where he attacks your character. But I think I know who you are, Ambassador. I think the country knows who you are. He smeared you when you were in Ukraine. He smeared you on that phone call with President Zelensky on July 25. He is smearing you right now as you are testifying. Ambassador Ivanovich, are the president's smears going to stop you from fighting corruption?
Well, I will continue with my work.
And if your country asks you again to fight corruption, will you still do that despite the smears?
Yes.
Thank you. I yield back.
Mr. Hurd.
Your Excellency, 33 years. We'll move over here. 33 years. Six Senior Foreign Service Performance Awards, five State Department Superior Honor Awards, the Presidential Distinguished Service Award, and the Secretary's Diplomacy and Human Rights Award. You're tough as nails, and you're smart as hell.
You're a great example of what our ambassadors should be like. You're an honor to your family. You are an honor to the Foreign Service. You are an honor to this country. And I thank you for all that you have done and will continue to do on behalf of your country. Now, I'm nervous about what I'm getting ready to do. I want to do a five-year history of Ukraine in about 45 seconds. And now that you're a professor, you can grade my paper, okay? Valentine's Day 2014, the Ukrainian people get fed up with the Ukrainian president Yanukovych and basically overthrow him. He goes on the run. This was the revolution of dignity. Who was the acting president during that time when Yanukovych went out?
I think it was...
Turchynov, is that how you say it?
Turchynov, thank you for helping me.
Turchynov, okay, excellent. Then in March of 2014, that is when we saw little green men coming into Ukraine, and ultimately the Russians invade the Ukraine and not only try to annex Crimea, but also try to... they invade the entire country in the eastern Donbass as well.
Yes.
Then there was an election, and the Ukrainian president was Poroshenko. That was in June of 2014. Then you came to post in 2016 of August. Is that correct?
2 years later.
January 2017, Trump was elected. And in December of 2017 is when the javelins were approved, mm-hmm. right? And we saw those javelins delivered in April of 2018 to be put to first use. Then we had Zelensky elected in 2019, April, correct? Mm-hmm. Now, the Zelensky defeated the previous president, Poroshenko.
Yes.
There's no love lost between those two dudes, is there?
I don't think so.
Okay. And then in May of 2019, Zelensky is sworn in.
Yes.
So my questions, we talk a lot about Rudy Giuliani. Do we know what officials within the Zelensky regime he actually met with? I know two. A gentleman named by Yermak, who was one of Zelensky's senior advisors. And then we also know of the former attorney general that we've already established here, was corrupt, Lushenko. Right? And Mr. Lushenko served under Zelensky for a couple of months, up until August, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And their parliament basically voted him out, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
So if Rudy Giuliani is trying to influence the Zelensky regime, would a guy that worked under the previous regime, under Poroshenko, be the right guy to do it?
So are you saying Mr. Lutsenko?
Yes.
That he
did Mr. Lutsenko have much credibility within the Zelensky regime, the current regime?
I don't think so.
He didn't. Now, Mr. Yermak, do you know of any other Ukrainians that Mr. Giuliani was meeting with that was part of the Zelensky regime?
Well, just to remind, I would have already have left Ukraine by that point.
But
I'm not aware.
Even with the administration to come, right? Zelensky won the election. There was a two-month period of preparing to be installed as president. Even during that time, were you aware of any contact?
There is one of the oligarchs, as we've heard about. One of the oligarchs is named Mr. Kolomoisky, and he met with Mr. Fruman and Mr. Parnas, and was apparently to get a meeting for Mr. Giuliani.
But those are not people that were actually in government or became in the Zelensky regime, is that correct?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I yield back. Thank you.
Mr. Castro.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Ambassador, for your 33 years of service to our nation. A big question here today is why you were pushed aside as Ambassador. For example, Americans know that an employer has a right to fire an employee, but they shouldn't do it for certain reasons. You shouldn't be fired because you're disabled, because you're a woman, because you're black, and for other reasons. And I think most Americans agree that a president shouldn't fire an ambassador or recall an ambassador because the ambassador is standing in his way of doing a corrupt act. So I want to ask you, did the president ever tell you why he was recalling you?
No.
Did anybody at the White House ever tell you why you were being recalled?
No.
Did the president ever consult you about who the good guys and the bad guys were in the Ukraine?
No.
Did Secretary Pompeo ever tell you why you were being recalled?
No.
And it appears in the testimony that we've heard in the Intelligence Committee so far that there were a group of the president's men, perhaps Secretary Perry, Rudy Giuliani, Ambassador Sondland, who were in on this scheme to help the president get the Bidens and Burisma investigated. And I want to put aside President Trump for just a second and ask you, in all of your years of service, have you ever come across a president, been asked by a president, or known of colleagues who were asked by an American president to have to help help that president get an American investigated overseas?
I'm not aware of that.
And if a president asked you to investigate a former vice president for this purpose, what would you have said?
I mean, with what I know today, I would have said no.
And would you have considered an unlawful act?
I don't know that it's unlawful per se, but I think, again, that there are channels for conducting proper investigations, and that that would have been the best way to handle something like this.
But certainly it would be, it's bizarre for a president to ask that some American be investigated by another government.
It's very unusual.
And also, you mentioned that there is corruption in Ukraine. Ukraine isn't the only country that that confronts corruption. If the people in power in a country where corruption is rampant are being asked by a foreign leader who's got a lot of leverage over them to conduct an investigation, could that be dangerous because they could trump up charges against someone if they wanted?
They could.
And I also want to ask you, I spoke to Ambassador Kent. He made a comment yesterday about selective prosecutions and what it means going forward, what kind of precedent it sets. And you've spoken about a dangerous precedent for the State Department and for diplomats. But I want you to help us consider the precedent going forward. If there's no consequences for President Trump, or really any president who does this, what are the consequences for this country and for any American, not just a former vice president or a presidential candidate or even somebody in politics, but a person in business who does business in Saudi Arabia or some other country? If a president is going to speak to another head of state or some foreign official and try to get that person investigated, what does that mean for the future of the country and for Americans?
Well, I think that investigations, prosecutions, judicial decisions properly should remain with investigators, prosecutors, and the courts. And I think that, as I said before, I think Senator Vandenberg, when he said that politics needs to stop at the water's edge, I think he was right in that.
I yield back to the chairman.
Mr. Ratcliffe.
Thank the chairman, and Ambassador Yovanovitch, I'd like to join all of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle in thanking you for your service. I'd like to ask you about your earlier testimony about your Senate confirmation, and Congresswoman Stefanik had asked you how the Obama-Biden State Department had prepared you to answer questions about Burisma and Hunter Biden specifically. You recall that?
Yes.
And
yes.
She mentioned that you had been asked or been prepared for a question about Hunter Biden's role on the board of Burisma, but I don't think that you gave us the answer or answers that the Obama-Biden State Department prepared you to give in response to that question. Do you remember what those answers were?
Yeah. It was something along the lines of, I would refer you to the vice president's office on that.
So did they, in the course of that, brief you about the amount of money that Hunter Biden was being paid by Burisma?
No. This wasn't part of a briefing. I mean, I had sort of big old books with
right.
questions that might come up.
In preparation for your confirmation. And they thought that Hunter Biden's role at Burisma might be significant enough that it would come up during your confirmation. Is that correct?
Apparently so. I mean, there were hundreds of questions.
Well, hundreds of questions, but were there hundreds of companies? How many companies other than Burisma did the Obama-Biden State Department prepare you to give answers for? And if so, if there were others, which ones?
I just don't recall.
You don't recall that there were any other companies, is that correct?
I'm quite sure there probably were some companies, but I mean, you know, this is a while ago and I don't recall.
But you specifically recall Burisma?
Yes.
All right. Out of thousands of companies in the Ukraine, the only one that you recall the Obama-Biden State Department preparing you to answer questions about was the one where the vice president's son was on the board. Is that fair?
Yes.
You understood from Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent's testimony, as it's been related to you, that he testified a few days ago. Do you understand that that arrangement, Hunter Biden's role on the Burisma board, caused him enough concern that, as he testified in his statement, that in February of 2015, I raised my concern that Hunter Biden's status as a board member could create the perception of a conflict of interest. He went on to talk about the vice president's responsibilities over the Ukraine and, or over Ukrainian policy as one of those factors. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Did you ever, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
That it was a legitimate concern to raise?
I think that it could raise the appearance of a conflict of interest.
And did you discuss that ever with Mr. Kent?
I don't believe so.
Shortly before your confirmation in August of 2016, Prosecutor General Shokin was fired by President Poroshenko, correct?
Yes.
And Prosecutor General Shokin was the one who had opened the investigation into Burisma, correct?
I think that's right, but I'm not actually sure.
He was in charge of it, at least at that point in time, as the prosecutor general.
Mm-hmm.
And are you aware of the very public statements by the vice president that that firing of the prosecutor general occurred in March of 2016, 6 hours after the vice president told President Poroshenko that he needed to fire the prosecutor general or that he wouldn't receive $1 billion from the United States? Do you recall that?
Yes.
All right. And do you think that that raises a potential concern or conflict of interest that the vice president of the United States was ordering the firing of the prosecutor in charge of a company that has been identified as one that is substantially corrupt?
I actually don't. I don't think that the view that Mr. Shokin was not a good prosecutor general fighting corruption, I don't think that had anything to do with the Burisma case.
But the legitimate concern about Hunter Biden's role was legitimate, correct?
I think it creates a concern that there could be an appearance of...
Well, based on your testimony, Ambassador, I'd like to renew my request, Mr. Chairman, that Hunter Biden's testimony that has been requested...
Time of the gentleman has expired.
...requested by the Republicans be considered...
The gentleman has expired.
...as legitimate rather than as a sham, as the...
General was suspended.
...referred to
General
by the chairman.
Your time has expired.
I have a unanimous...
Mr. Heck,
I have a
you're
unanimous
recognized.
Consent request.
You're not recognized. Mr. Heck, you are.
Ambassador, I'd like to thank you very much, add my voice of gratitude for your years of service. Frankly, you're the best of this nation, and I cannot think of anybody else I would rather have representing us in a foreign capital than you.
Thank you.
My colleagues have gone to a great deal of effort to better understand the facts surrounding your removal. I think the facts are pretty clear. There was a smear campaign. And it was orchestrated by a corrupt Ukrainian prosecutor, the president's attorney, the president's son, and even some of the president's allies at his favorite TV station. So that campaign led to your removal, despite 33 years of outstanding service, progressive responsibility, and awards. And so I kind of sit here with a mix of emotions. On the one hand, there's some pride and gratitude for all your outstanding service. And on the other hand, I'm angry, like my friend from Connecticut. In fact, I'm very angry about how it is the most powerful person on the face of the earth would remove you from office after your stellar service and somehow feel compelled to characterize you as bad news and then to ominously threaten that you're going to go through some things. So I am angry, but I'm not surprised. After all, as was suggested earlier, he said the whistleblower may have committed treason, a crime punishable by death, even though the whistleblower strictly adhered to the letter of the law as independently attested to by both the Trump-appointed inspector general and the acting DNI. After all, he even demeaned the memory of Senator McCain after he lied in his grave at the Naval Academy grounds, despite a lifetime of public service and serving 6 years as a prisoner of war in a tiny cell in Hanoi, being beaten and tortured every day. And after all, he belittled the Gold Star Khan family, whose son, Captain Khan, gave his last full measure of devotion out of love for this country. And let me tell you, as somebody whose older brother never saw his 35th birthday because of service in the Vietnam War, those words are deeply offensive. Words matter, and the words leveled against you constitute bullying of the worst order. Your good character, your outstanding reputation have been besmirched in a way that is devoid of common decency. But here's my message to you. There is nothing, Ambassador Yovanovitch, nothing he can say or do, not a thing, that will in any way diminish the nature and quality of the service you have rendered to our great nation. Not a thing. And there is not a thing he can say or do that will diminish our gratitude to you for that service. And I thank you again for it.
Thank you. Thank you.
So as to the larger point, I would like you to answer, what does this mean to Ukraine when the United States actually engages in the kind of behavior that we are attempting to discourage them from engaging in, namely a politically motivated prosecution? What does that mean to our what does that mean to them in their struggling efforts to become a robust democracy? What's the impact in Ukraine for this behavior?
Yeah. Well, I think Ukraine, like many countries, looks to us for the power of our example. And I think that when we engage in questionable activities, that raises a question. And it emboldens those who are corrupt, who don't want to see Ukraine become a democracy, a free market economy, a part of Europe, but want Ukraine to stay in, under Russia's thrall. And that's not in our national security interests.
Thank you, Ambassador Yovanovitch. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I yield the balance of my time to the chair.
I think the gentleman, I understand that either the witness or counsel would like to take a short break. Let's take a five-minute recess.
Okay.
If members of the audience could please remain in the seats to allow the witness or counsel to leave ahead of us, we will resume in a few minutes. We are in recess. return to order. Mr. Jordan, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, thank you for being here. Thank you for your service to our country. Ambassador, should ambassadors ever try to influence host country elections?
No.
I think you said in your opening statement, partisanship of this type is not compatible with the role of a career foreign service officer. Is that right?
Yeah.
But that's exactly what happened in 2016. In August of 2016, the very month you went to Ukraine as our ambassador, the Ukrainian ambassador here in the United States, Ambassador Chali, wrote an op-ed in The Hill, said this, Trump's comments send wrong message. So the very month you're over there as our ambassador to Ukraine, Ambassador Chali writes that op-ed, and it wasn't just that attack, as Mr. Castor got into earlier, it wasn't just that attack on the president. We had former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, who criticized candidate Trump. We had Mr. Avakov. I believe earlier you said, Ambassador, that Mr. Avakov was the individual who first alerted you to the efforts of Mr. Giuliani. Mr. Avakov, back during this same time period, in the months just prior to the 2016 election, called then-candidate Trump all kinds of names, called him a terrorist. And, of course, we have Mr. Lushenko, a member of parliament, who was a source for Fusion GPS and now somewhat famous dossier that flowed from Fusion's work. He said this in the Financial Times again in August of 2016 when you first arrived in Ukraine. He said this, the majority of Ukrainian politicians are on Hillary Clinton's side. So you had several high-ranking officials in the government, in the Ukrainian government, and President Poroshenko is president of Ukraine, criticized President Trump, then candidate Trump, all in the late summer and fall of 2016. What I want to know, Ambassador, when this was all happening, did you go talk to anyone in the Ukrainian government about this? Did you go say to some of these officials, hey, you guys need to knock this off, this perception that we got, as Mr. Lushenko said, the majority of Ukrainian politicians on Hillary Clinton's side, that's not good. Did you have that conversation?
No.
Didn't talk to anyone in the government? Did you talk to President Poroshenko?
No.
Didn't alert anyone in the government?
No.
Well, one of the things we've heard so much over the last 6 weeks in depositions and, frankly, in the hearing on Wednesday is how important bipartisan support is for Ukraine. Democrats and Republicans agree they want to help Ukraine. In fact, the Democrats' first witness, their star witness on Wednesday, Mr. Taylor said Ukraine's most important strategic asset is this bipartisan support. And you would agree with that, right?
I do.
He said this in his testimony on Wednesday. On September 11th, I learned that the hold had been lifted the next day. Ambassador Taylor said, I conveyed this news to President Zelensky and the Ukrainian foreign minister, and I reminded Mr. Yarmak of the high strategic value of bipartisan support for Ukraine and the importance of not getting involved in other countries' elections. So what I'm wondering is, this is the day after the aid's been lifted that Ambassador Taylor made this statement to the Ukrainian government. And he makes this after there's nothing been done by Ukraine to influence our election. Because President Zelensky didn't announce he was doing an investigation and the aid was lifted. But he felt he needed to say that. But in 2016, when we know that the majority of Ukrainian politicians want Clinton to win, because it was said by a member of parliament, when the ambassador to the United States from Ukraine writes an op-ed criticizing then-candidate Trump, when Mr. Avakov calls candidate Trump all kinds of names, nobody goes and talks to him and tells him to knock it off. Did you have any conversations, Ambassador, with Victoria Nuland or Secretary of State Perry about what was going on in 2016 and this majority of Ukrainian politicians being for candidate Clinton and not and opposed to President Trump?
No, I did not.
No one did anything. No one did anything. You see why maybe the president was a little concerned about what went on in Ukraine? And you couple that with the corruption level that we know exists in Ukraine, you add to that this idea that he's not a big fan of foreign aid, why he might be a little concerned about sending the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people to Ukraine?
I'm sorry, is there a question there?
There was.
Okay. Could you repeat it, please?
I'm asking...
Time of the gentleman has expired, but I'll allow you to repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm asking, maybe we can kind of see why the president was a little concerned when you have the highest-ranking officials in the government, the ambassador criticizing him, parliamentary member Lushenko criticizing him, when you have Avakov, the guy who first told you about Giuliani, criticizing him. All this going on, and when you couple that with the concerns he has about corruption, the concerns he has about Europe not doing enough, the concerns he has about reluctance to send in the hard-earned tax dollars to any country,
Jordan,
frankly.
I have indulged you with extra time, but
I appreciate
my indulgence is wearing out.
I appreciate it.
There is a question, right?
Our indulgence wore out with you a long time ago, Mr. Chairman.
I'll tell you that. I'm about to gavel you down, so if you have a question, I suggest you
I'm asking her, is do you think there's maybe a reason that this was that President Trump's concern was justified?
You know, I can't speak for the president on this, but what I would say is you've listed a number of actions. I think from my point of view, that doesn't create a Ukrainian government strategy to interfere in our election.
I didn't say that.
Mr. Jordan, please allow the ambassador to answer the question.
So I would just say that, you know, U.S. politicians will often criticize policies of foreign counterparts, even perhaps during their elections. You know, this happens in politics, and I think that it doesn't necessarily constitute interference.
Would you ever write an op-ed,
Jordan, your time
critical
expired.
Of a presidential Jordan, candidate in Ukraine?
Jordan, your time has expired. Mr. Welch, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like everybody here, I'm extraordinarily grateful to you for your career at public service, and I feel very badly about what you've had to endure. Your colleagues, you don't complain. You're doing your job. I feel badly about the insults, the tweet this morning, the fact that you were smeared, not fired. But the question, as you know, is not how you were treated. Mm-hmm. The question is why the president did what he did, and whether what he did was a breach of trust. The question really is about whether the President of the United States, any president, has the authority to withhold congressionally approved aid, to condition a White House meeting on extracting from a foreign leader a willingness to assist him in his political campaign. That's the question. And that brings us to you as part of the story, because the question is, why were you fired from that position? I want to read a portion of the president's call on July 25th with President Zelensky. And this is the painful part when you first heard about it. The former ambassador from the United States, the woman, was bad news, and the people she was dealing with in Ukraine were bad news. So I just want to let you know that. The other thing, he goes right into this, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of the people want to find out about that, so whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. You indicated in response to my colleague Mr. Castro's question that if you were asked to approach a foreign leader and condition American support on their being involved in our campaign, you would refuse to do that.
Yes.
And you're aware now, but I don't know if you were then, but that July 25th phone call occurred the day after Director Mueller reported that the interference in our 2016 campaign was not from Ukraine. It was active, concerted, energetic, and by the Russians, correct?
Yes.
Now, as ambassador, you had no knowledge of whatever it is President Trump ultimately seems to have wanted to get for cooperation in this investigation. Isn't that, that's correct?
Yes.
All right. Now, you've been asked about whether a president has authority to replace an ambassador, and you have agreed that that's the president's prerogative.
Yes, that's true.
But that assumes that the reasons are not related to the personal, private, political interests of the president at the expense of our national security. Right?
Yes.
And you've been the target of insults from the president. You join some very distinguished company, by the way. Senator McCain, General Kelly, man I admire, I think all of us do, General Mattis. We're not here to talk about that unless the reason you get insulted is you did today, essentially blaming you for Somalia, is if this is another step by the president to intimidate witnesses. He didn't intimidate you. You're here. You've endured. But there are other people out there that can expect the Trump treatment if they come forward. That's a question for us. Now, you also indicated that the president has a prerogative to appoint a non-career person, and to be candid, Republican presidents and Democratic presidents have done that. Mr. Sondland's transcript is out, and he was someone who indicated that everything hinged, the White House meeting and the release of the vital defensive aid, everything hinged on the President Zelensky being willing to do that investigation that would benefit the Trump campaign. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And you've indicated that's something that you would not agree to do?
Yes.
And Sondland was quite willing to do?
Apparently so.
I thank you for your professional service, and I yield back.
Thank you.
Mr. Maloney.
Ambassador Yovanovitch, thank you for being here. It's been a long day. You know, the first time we met, it wasn't clear, and so I just want to start with a quick comment. But, you know, your testimony in this inquiry broke the dam. You were the first one through that stone wall that the president was trying to set up. And I just want to thank you for that, because others have followed your example. And there's an old expression that first person through the wall gets a little bit bloody. And I think you must understand that expression in a new way. But thank you.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about the day you were let go. And I know this is a painful series of events, so forgive me, but I think it's very important. It's April 24th, and you told us a few things that really stuck with me. You said you were at the embassy in Ukraine. You were honoring a Ukrainian woman, an anti-corruption activist. I believe her name is Katerina Handzyuk. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Am I saying that correctly?
Mm-hmm. I was at my house.
You're at your house, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And you were giving her the Woman of Courage Award, I believe.
Yeah, the Embassy Kyiv's Woman of Courage Award.
Right. And, of course, that's the day you get a call from Carol Perez, a senior member of the Foreign Service. Did you know Carol Perez?
Yes.
You're both senior women in the Foreign Service. You had an opportunity to meet her before?
Yes.
And she says there's trouble coming. Want to give you a heads up. Correct me if I get this wrong, and I don't know a lot, but it's coming from the White House. I'll call you later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sums it up.
But you're literally that evening honoring this anti-corruption activist. Is that right?
Yes.
And not just any woman, but a woman who was, you said, horribly attacked and killed for her efforts. And she wasn't just killed. You said I believe that someone threw acid on her.
That's correct.
And I went and I checked during the break, and it turns out she was horribly injured, and it took 4 months for her to die. Is that right?
A very painful death.
Why would somebody attack her with acid? There are easier ways to kill people. Why do you think they did it with acid?
Well, I think they wanted her out of the way, but I think the message was this could happen to you too if you continue her work.
That's what happens when you go up against corrupt people in Ukraine.
It is something that can happen. I mean, there are other ways of sidelining people.
Do you remember speaking at that event?
I do.
I went and looked at what you said. You said, Katerina paid the ultimate price for her fearlessness in fighting against corruption and for her determined efforts to build a democratic Ukraine. Do you remember saying that?
Yes.
And then your phone rings. And you hear this trouble up the street. And Carol Perez called you back later that night, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was 1 a.m., I believe.
Yes.
Were you sleeping?
No.
You had stayed up?
Yes.
To get the phone call?
Yes.
And that's when she says two things, I believe, that really stuck with me. She said, we're worried about your security.
Yes.
You've just been honoring a woman who was killed for fighting for her anti-corruption efforts. And she says, you got to get on the next plane. Was she speaking euphemistically, get on the next plane, you know, when you get time? Did she mean literally the next plane?
Well, I think she meant, you know, as soon as possible. But pretty much it was the next plane.
And that's a pretty good flight back from Kyiv to Washington, and you're on your way to meet with Deputy Secretary Sullivan.
Yes.
And he says to you two things. He says there was a concerted effort against you, and he says you've done nothing wrong.
Right.
And when he said, what I'm fascinated about is when he says you've done nothing wrong, what did you expect the United States government would do next?
You know, it was pretty clear that a decision had been made by the president, implemented by the State Department, that I had to leave Ukraine. But I'd hoped that there would be more public support.
Did you expect them to have your back?
Yes.
And were you surprised when you found out they weren't going to?
Not at that point anymore.
Why?
Well, because over the last several months, that had not been the case.
Ma'am, in your opening statement, you said, how could our system fail like this?
Yeah.
How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? How could our system fail like this? How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? I want you to know, ma'am, that is the very question we are determined to get an answer for. And I want to thank you on behalf of your country for your service and with our work in answering that question. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ms. Demings.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador, everyone in this room should be thankful for your service to our nation. I have four little girls in my life, and as I sit here thinking about them and as a woman, I could not be prouder of you, and I consider you an inspiration for women around the world. I just have to say before I get into my questioning is I think it's disgraceful to hear my colleagues refer to your sworn testimony as a performance today or speak in a condescending way, basically suggesting that the woman, because I think that's how the president referred to you, I'm not sure he knows your name or there's some other meaning there, but to basically suggest that the woman should be thankful for whatever she was left with, smear campaign and all after you were recalled. But I want you to know today that we thank you for your service, your 33 years of service. Ambassador, on a press conference call on October 17th, Acting White House Chief of Staff Mulvaney discussed his belief that it's entirely appropriate to politicize U.S. foreign policy. Here's what he said. If you read the news reports and you believe them, what did McKinley say yesterday? Well, McKinley said yesterday that he was really upset with the political influence in foreign policy. That was one of the reasons he was so upset about this. And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. Ambassador Yovanovitch, do you share the concern raised by Ambassador McKinley in testimony before this committee about political influence in foreign policy?
Well, as I said before, I think it's important to keep political influence out of foreign policy because we all, whether we are Republican or Democrats or something else, have common security interests, and that needs to be safeguarded and advanced.
And what message do you think it sends to other foreign service officers and public service, which we so desperately need good ones, when an administration refuses to support its own officials in the face of a smear campaign?
Well, it's deeply troubling. It's deeply troubling, and there are morale issues at the State Department.
Morale issues at the State Department. I can understand why. On March 20th of 2019, President Trump tweeted an article that included a letter from Representative Pete Sessions that said you had, and I quote, spoken privately and repeatedly about your disdain for the current administration in a way that might call for the expulsion of you as your ambassador to Ukraine immediately. Did you speak publicly and privately about your disdain for the Trump administration?
No.
Why do you think the president would want to push such a lie?
I don't know.
Policies change, but U.S. interests don't. Not for those who are seeking to do the work of protecting our nation, the work you have done for decades. The president, his chief of staff, and his allies seem to want nothing more than to smear the good people trying to protect this country and to hijack our institutions for their personal and political gain. Again, Ambassador, we thank you so much for your service, and I'll yield my remaining time to the chairman.
Thank you.
I thank the gentlewoman. I'm going to go to Mr. Krishnamurthy.
Good afternoon, Ambassador, and thank you to the family as well.
Thank you for
being here in support of you today. I'd like to direct you to an area of bipartisanship, namely aid to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Congress, on an overwhelmingly bipartisan basis, has appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine, correct?
Yes.
And that aid is being used by Ukraine to fight a common adversary, namely Russia, right?
Yes.
The U.S., in fact, has consistently partnered with other European countries to keep Russia at bay and maintain the peace in Europe, right?
Yes.
As Ambassador Taylor suggested earlier this week, supporting Ukraine helps maintain peace so that Americans don't have to go to war again in Europe, right?
Yes.
Suspending that aid and weakening Ukraine can increase the likelihood of the opposite, correct?
Yes, it is extremely short-sighted.
The last time you were in Ukraine was May 20th of this year, right?
Yes.
In his opening statement, Ambassador Taylor said he took charge in Ukraine on June 17th.
Yes.
Therefore, there was almost a one-month gap between the time you departed and when Taylor took over, right?
Yes. Yes.
During that time, on May 20th, Ambassador Sondland, Rick Perry, and others came to the inauguration of President Zelensky, right?
Yes.
And during that gap in time, Ambassador Sondland visited the White House, along with others, and got directions from President Trump to talk to Rudy. Those were his words. Talk to Rudy about what to do in Ukraine, right?
That's my understanding.
In other words, isn't it the case that your departure and the one-month gap between the time you left and when Ambassador Taylor arrived provided the perfect opportunity for another group of people to basically take over Ukraine policy? Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Ambassador, you're going to have to speak a little louder into the mic.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. On page 10 of your opening statement, you mentioned, quote-unquote, corrupt interests apparently hijacking our Ukraine policy, right?
Yes.
A couple of suspect individuals in that regard were Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, right?
Yes.
You mentioned in response to Minority Counsel earlier that you learned that Fruman and Parnas were attempting to open a liquefied natural gas company, correct?
Yes.
How did you learn that, by the way?
I heard it from the Minister of Interior.
Interestingly, at noon today, The Wall Street Journal reported that federal prosecutors in Manhattan are investigating whether Rudy Giuliani stood to personally profit from that liquefied natural gas venture. Do you have any knowledge of that?
No, I do not.
Maybe we should talk to Rudy, huh? Ambassador, I'd like to direct you to another line of questioning that I had for Ambassador Taylor earlier this week. He said that there were irregular channels of diplomacy at work in Ukraine, circumventing normal diplomatic channels and threatening American interests in favor of private interests. I asked him the question, can you rule out the possibility that these irregular channels of diplomacy are being used in other countries where we conduct foreign policy? In response, he said that he could not rule it out. Ambassador Yovanovitch, I ask you, and I assume that you can't rule it out either, correct?
I can't, but I would also add I have no knowledge of that.
I understand. Are you concerned that these irregular channels of diplomacy may be at work elsewhere?
I think it's a possibility.
You testified that it was a, quote-unquote, dangerous precedent that private interests and people who don't like a particular ambassador could combine to replace that ambassador. Are you concerned that other ambassadors may suffer the same fate as you?
Yes.
Ambassador, in your service as an American diplomat, you have encountered various dictators and strong men ruling other countries, right?
Yes.
In your personal life, your parents fled the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, and they became familiar with despots and dictators as well, correct?
Yes.
Indeed, you're an authority on authoritarianism, right?
Well, maybe.
Is it a feature of authoritarianism to allow corrupt interests to hijack foreign policy?
Yeah.
Is it a feature of authoritarianism for the rulers there to claim absolute rights?
Yes.
And is it a hallmark of authoritarianism for those rulers to smear their opponents?
Sometimes, yes.
Thank you.
Time of the gentleman has expired. Mr. Nunes, do you have any concluding remarks?
I would just say to the American people, today's show trial has come to an end. We're headed down now to the basement of the Capitol to go until I don't know what time, and we'll be back there hiding again behind the closed doors, interviewing more witnesses that you may or may not be able to see in the public. I hate to break it to my colleagues if there's anyone else out there watching television ratings, but they must be plummeting right now. And I would suggest that we get back to the work of the Intelligence Committee, that we pass a trade agreement with the United States, Mexico, and Canada that would actually help the American people out, because this is an embarrassment. I'll yield back.
Mr. Chairman, may I be recognized for a motion?
No, I have some concluding remarks. Ambassador, I want to thank you for your decades of service. I want to thank you, as Mr. Maloney said, for being the first one through the gap. What you did in coming forward in answering a lawful subpoena was to give courage to others that also witnessed wrongdoing, that they too could show the same courage that you have, that they could stand up, speak out, answer questions. They could endure whatever threats, insults, may come their way. And so in your long and distinguished career, you have done another great public service in answering the call of our subpoena and testifying before us today. I think you gathered from our comments that we not only grieve for what you went through, but what damage is being done to the State Department, to career federal foreign service officers all over the country. I am profoundly grateful to you and Mr. Kent and Ambassador Taylor, who have done so much in the last 2 days or 3 days to show the American people the face of our diplomatic corps, the extraordinary public servants who work all around the world in very dangerous places, as you have. And so I'm glad they've gotten to see you
because you're often vilified as bureaucrats or diplomacy is diminished as unimportant. Anything other than military doesn't really matter when it's your efforts that often prevent us from going to war. Sometimes you're disparaged as the deep state. But what you are is what holds this country together, what holds our foreign policy together, what makes it seamless, what makes it work. And I'm glad America gets to see that. I will just emphasize once again about the importance of your testimony. Mr. Kent and Ambassador Taylor gave us the broad outlines of this story. This is a story about an effort to coerce, condition, or bribe a foreign country into doing the dirty work of the president, investigations of his political rival, by conditioning U.S. taxpayer money, by conditioning a meeting that President Zelensky desperately wanted and needed to establish that relationship with the most powerful patron of Ukraine, the United States of America. The fact that they failed in this solicitation of bribery doesn't make it any less bribery, doesn't make it any less immoral or corrupt. It just means it was unsuccessful. And to that we owe other dedicated public servants who blew the whistle. Had they not blown the whistle, we wouldn't be here. And I think it is appalling that my colleagues continue to want to out this whistleblower so that he or she can be punished by this president. But let's underscore once again, while you are the beginning of this story, you're not the end of it, but nonetheless, the beginning is important because the beginning of the story is an effort to get you out of the way, an effort by Rudy Giuliani and Fruman and Parnas and corrupt Ukrainians like Lutsenko to get you out of the way. Because they felt you were an impediment to these political investigations the president so desperately wanted. Giuliani has made it abundantly clear he was in Ukraine on a mission for his client, for the president, to investigate the Bidens. And you were viewed as an obstacle that had to go, not just by Giuliani, but by the president of the United States. And if people had any doubt about it, they should do what the president asks, read the transcript. And what they'll see in that transcript is the president praises the corrupt. He praises the corrupt, Lutsenko. He condemns the just, you. And then he asks for an investigation of the Bidens. There is no camouflaging that corrupt intent. We are adjourned.
Mr. Speaker, I'll speak on condition.
Mr. Chairman, you disparage
those members on this side of the aisle. We should have a chance to respond to your disparaging remarks. Mr. Chairman, I demand or seek. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.